The Senate Revenue Committee, and we're going to open a work session on Senate Bill 841, setting up a reserve fund. Lynn, if you want to come up, I don't know, frankly, I think we're ready to go, but we'll have you at our disposal. And Paul Warner.
Mr. Chair, Senate Bill 841, you've had two previous amendments that you've looked at and not adopted either one. And then a dash three you have today as a new one. To remind you, on the dash one amendment, that was to put the stability fund in the general fund, and what it would do is allow the Treasury to manage the cash flow for general fund purposes. It would have the benefit of lowering interest costs in the general fund, but the cost of not retaining interest for the stability fund. The dash two is just a technical change for the language, clarifying that it's the percentage that is used for the calculation of the ending balance is the legislatively approved budget adjusted for reversions. And those reversions are known 6 months after the biennium ends. So that's a technical amendment. The dash three amendments is the new one. And what that does is that it would be a substitute for the dash one amendments, because it would take the ending balance as the revenue source up to 2% of general fund appropriations, and when the calculation is done following the biennium, and this would be probably in January or February following the biennium, it would transfer that ending balance calculation into the Education Stability Fund. And therefore, it would become a revenue source for the Education Stability Fund. And keep in mind that the triggers in the original bill and Senate Bill 841 are the same as the current Education Stability Fund.
Questions?
Yes,
Mr. Chair.
Senator Starr.
As I understand it, we're looking at not moving the 1 and 2.
I think we need the twos.
We need the twos
for language purposes.
Okay. All right. Misunderstood. And then I would move the dash two amendments to Senate Bill 841.
Senator Starr has moved the dash two amendments to Senate Bill 841. Not 841.
Yes, 841.
841. Mm-hmm. Any discussion? Any objection to that? So, Senator Starr.
Chair, I move the dash three amendments to Senate Bill 841.
Senator Starr has moved the dash three amendments to Senate Bill 841, the reserve fund proposal. Any discussion? Senator George.
Question. Down on line 14 and 15, where it talks about that money may be used as other monies in the general fund. I better restate that. May be used as other money in the general fund are used. Okay, the question there is does that undermine the protections in the stability fund?
What line are you on?
Line. I'm dash three.
Yeah.
Lines 15 and 16.
Okay.
In other words, does that open up the stability fund? I don't think so.
No, this is if the amount of the education now the Education Stability Fund is remember has the cap on it, mm-hmm. of 5% of the prior biennium a budget. Now, what happens with the lottery that's dedicated is that once you reach the 5%, the lottery dedication drops from 18 to 15%, and it goes into a school matching capital fund.
Right.
What happens with this revenue source is, instead of once you reach the cap,
okay.
instead of going into that school sub-account, capital sub-account, it goes back to the general fund.
Okay.
So it's not a revenue source going to the school capital matching fund. It's just a revenue source to fill up the Education Stability Fund, and once that's filled up, then it goes back to the general fund.
Well, I don't like that. Why do we have it going back to the general fund and not to the capital matching fund?
Mr. Chair, we would have, if we had the, that's a policy decision. Once your cap is full, you would be having the 15% of lottery flowing into the school capital matching fund.
Mm-hmm.
So you would have two sources going into the school capital matching fund with a full stability fund.
Which I like a lot. Where's the committee on that? I like that. But where's the rest of us? Senator Metzman and Senator Starr.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. As I mentioned in our first public hearing on this bill, I'm concerned about two aspects about using the stability fund as that source. One of which is the prospect, without the vote of the people and the constitutional increasing the cap, that this could actually be capped 36 months from now, 48 months now, short order. And it doesn't necessarily get us to where we want to go, which is to have greater reserves. Keeping in mind we could go to the voters for that, but that's a second step. Whereas under the original intent, if we created simply a reserve fund, we would allow those to go as the stability fund to grow as it has been authorized to grow. We'd certainly always have the option to raise the cap, but at the same time, we would have a parallel revenue source that would get us closer to building the kind of reserves that we really want. The other issue that I also mentioned in the first hearing is I'm still concerned that while the stability fund is, in fact, a reserve fund, the political dynamic hasn't really convinced people that we don't, the very fact that people say we have to have a rainy day fund, we have sufficiently confused people that we don't have a reserve fund. And I don't think that ends that debate. So I'm concerned about capping the stability fund in short order and then still having a debate about a reserve fund. And I'm just wondering if that issue could be solved now rather than continuing that debate further. I think the overall policy is that we need to do what we can to build these reserve funds, and I will support the will of the committee to advance whatever issue, because I think that is more important than the others, but I'm not sure that this is the best way to do that.
Thank you. Lynn, I don't know if you want to jump in to answer. I mean, Senator Metzger raises some good points. For me, it is, and this is statutory, we're at 2% or around 2% right now reserves, which just makes them inadequate. This would get you to 5% projected at January 1st, 2010, so it gives us 5 years to get to that 2010 date where we would get to 5%. And to me, using the end imbalance is the politically feasible way to actually get to 5%. And the Stability Fund has the nice construct of it that it's difficult for us to tap other than in very recessionary times. Lynn, do you want to jump in?
Chair Deckert. This is simply an issue, I believe, where there's pros and cons on both sides of of that, and I don't know the perfect outcome on that. I, with all due respect to your wanting to really build or to go into the sub-account for school construction, I understand that. I would have to say from our position as OBA that our first priority is to make sure that we have an adequate reserve. Well, and 5%, we do not think that that's adequate by itself. Now, there may be some changes we can make down the road, but it is a potential here to fill this account, as Senator Metzger has mentioned, and then we will not go beyond that. If people, people won't raise the cap, and if the ending balance is flowing into that, and then the ending balance will now flow back to the general fund, then it seems like we have somewhat, I won't say circumvented, but we have prevented building the reserve as large as we need to. That's my major concern of that.
But we're constrained by that 5% unless we go to the voters.
Correct.
So it's just the only decision point we have. I guess we have two. One is, do you go to the voters and try to bump that 5%? And then secondly is, what do you do with the excess money if you actually get there, Senator Metzger mentioned, before you think you are? I mean, we project 2010 is the date that we get to the 5% reserves. Do you need to go to voters before then to bump your stability fund or your reserve fund past the 5%? I could be convinced, but I don't think this biennium is the time to go to voters because I just don't think we're going to get to the 5%.
Chair Deckard, I agree with that. This is not the time to go to the voters. If you went to the dash ones, you avoid a lot of those issues. That's the point of it. If you go to the dash ones, then you won't hit the cap on the stability fund as quickly. The revenue from the lottery will continue to have an option to flow into there and not hit the cap. And likewise, you would use the ending balance. So you have sort of a two-prong approach without any conflict. But that doesn't help you on wanting to go into your school assistance fund quickly.
That's true. Now I'm not glad I called you up. Things more Senator Starr.
Well, Mr. Chair, I think that the witness needs to identify himself for the record. Beyond that,
Len Lundquist, Morgan Best Association.
We are looking at a dilemma here. I agree that 5% is not enough. I think that we will have time to address that. I don't know that there's any better time than the present when we have so recently experienced the need for a reserve fund. As our witness just told us, it is a policy decision. And I guess I'm a bit conflicted. I think this is the way to build that reserve. We would have an opportunity in 2 years to deal with the amount of the reserve. And so I'm persuaded that we need to move this with the Dash 3 amendment and go forward.
Without the money going into the school capital matching grant for all these fast-growing capital needing school districts.
Tell me again how that school matching grant, what are the restrictions for accessing those funds?
Senator Starr, the original Measure 19 that went to the voters had the language establishing the sub-account and established it as a matching sub-account. I think those that developed that concept had worked closely with the treasurer on some bills that were considered in the legislature that would have established a fund in which the state and the local districts would match contributions for capital construction. Those bills never passed, so we don't have a implementing language right now on how that sub-account would be used. So that would be something that would need to be established.
Thank you.
Senator George.
Paul, you mentioned, did you say the word sub-accounts? When the original authorized, were there more than one? Can we utilize another portion if there is one?
I'm sorry, sir. It is identified as a sub-account in the Constitution.
Senator Prezansky, give thoughts.
I mean, it is policy decision. And the thing is, are we doing it now or, planning for the future? I mean, clearly we need to be looking at planning for the future. And I think that we need to make certain that, this is a reserve account, and as much as we find the need for today or yesterday, I think our goal has to be what's in the future for us. And I would be, I'm not sure as to which of the amendments that we need, but it just seems to me that we need to be planning to make certain that we maximize for the future, because I have to believe that we're coming out of the recession that we're currently experiencing, have been, and I think that we're looking for something to show and giving guidance back to the people of the state as to our
acknowledging that there will be another time, another economic downturn that we need to be prepared for. And so it seems to me that if we know we're not going to hit the 5% in 2 years, clearly we don't need to do anything with the voters or take anything from the voters immediately. And I think we need to really establish what is that level that we need, mm-hmm. as to what is our comfort. Mm-hmm. And then for the residue, where should that should it go back to the general fund? I mean, that's a policy issue.
That's the question. So what we'll do, because I hear the committee saying, yes, all agreed, let's get to the 5% as soon as we can, which looks like it'll be 2010. That question, so we'll get a -4 amendment drafted, and we'll return to this hopefully Monday, if we could post this Monday at 10.
Could we post Tuesday?
Let's post Tuesday.
Okay.
So we'll repost this Tuesday, and then the choice would just be, once you get to that 5%, if we haven't bumped the cap, which perhaps we'll have bumped the cap next session, but if you haven't bumped the cap, then does it go into a school capital matching fund, which I think is a good idea, or does it go to the general fund? And we can kind of think about that for the next few days and make that decision Tuesday morning.
Can I get a little bit more understanding on that matching fund, the criteria of who's actually accessing that? Because as much as what I'm hearing about fast-paced growing districts, I'm also concerned about the smaller rural districts that are basically, I mean, we've got a taxing system now that allows large landowners to basically defer their tax payments, and these small school districts are not getting the benefit there, and each student they lose that funding that goes for that student.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's one of those things that I want to make sure that we have a system that's in place that takes care of the needs across the state, and if we have tax deferments, which is appropriate, at the same time, shouldn't those school districts actually have the ability to maybe access some of this money, even though they're not, quote unquote, on the fast-paced track of growing? Because it seems to me then you're really favoring the urban districts over and suburban districts over the smaller rural districts.
Yeah, what we'll do on that, because this is we're going to have to deal with this in the formula. So Tuesday we'll have a little presentation.
That'd be great.
On the capital matching grant, how that fund works, addressing also Senator Starr's question, and just that whole issue. Who I had in mind is obviously the Eugene School District, Northern Douglas County. As an area that I
like
a great deal of growth.
Eastern Douglas would be nice too.
Starting some in Congress.
So let's do that. We'll return to this Tuesday. We'll talk. I mean, that's going to be the policy decision that we have, is kind of what we do today for existing districts and fast growing, and we'll make a call on should it go, where should that access once you get to the 5%. It could be all academic if we bump the cap.
And it may be, Mr. Chair, if I could, the thing about these smaller school districts, they may not be growing where they have the capital needs to building new buildings, but just replacement and maintaining what they have. Mm-hmm. And that's the point, I guess, I'm trying to figure out if they can capture or be part of that possible. Because, you know, they have so many, all the districts have so much push-pull and so many different directions. And it just seems to me that if we're going to have this matching of availability, let's see how we can allow all the school districts to have an opportunity to participate in that.
There could be an expanded definition of capital, which mm-hmm. is Ozzy in the room. we can do that. We can do that. Okay, so we'll...
So if I clarify, Mr. Chair, that the -4 amendments that the committee would be requesting would be similar to the -3s, essentially without the Section 2, Sub 2, stop the flow into the capital subaccount once the cap is reached. In other words, it would just continue to flow in as the lottery source does now.
Precisely. Because once the stability fund hits the 5%, maintain status quo in terms of...
Okay, continue to go in.
I like that even better. Just keep it the way it is. Great. Thanks, Glenn. Sorry to...
Chairman, just want to say for the record, I certainly can agree with you that I don't want it to go in just back to the general fund.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm in sync with that aspect of it, to go into the subaccount.
Great. Good. So you've come around.
No.
Senator Torres.
Maybe the question will help him clarify. Lynn, do you think that the language that was in dash one, separate, distinct from, and as in an account in, and the rest of those kind of concepts need to be in dash four so that you're really clarifying the dollars?
Chair Neckert, Senator George, no, I don't think so.
Okay.
I don't believe so.
Yeah, it's really where the fund is. I mean, you can have it in the general fund as kind of a separate part of the general fund.
Right.
We kind of decided, although we can revisit this, do you want to do that, or do we want to do the stability fund? Or do you want to do kind of outside the general fund, but distinct fund for these dollars?
Well, you're asking me, and I'm asking you. So we.
My vote's for the stability fund.
Okay.
Close the work session on Senate Bill 841, and we will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 171, and let's do a quick introduction of the bill. Paul, and I want to get Kevin Lynch up because he has a pressing engagement in Portland.
Mr. Chair, Senate Bill 171 has just come to you as a referral.
So it stays on the table.
You have before you Senate Bill 171 that has come from the Business and Economic Development Committee, and there's the staff measure summary from the committee administrator in that committee, and then a letter from Senator Metzger, the chair of the committee, recommending that the bill be referred to the Senate Revenue Committee. What the bill does is it implements the three recommendations that you received from Commissioner Beyer and the Public Utility Commission. And I did go ahead and make a copy of that first page for you. Those recommendations are requiring regulated utilities to file standalone income tax returns, not file consolidated returns, directing the Commission to consider consolidated tax benefits when it includes federal income taxes and customer rates, and also requires regulated utilities to file a general rate case at least every 5 years. So those elements are all in 171. I can go through those if you like in a minute.
I think we should, but I want to get Senator Metzger. Do you want to make a few comments? We're just kind of introducing 171.
Well, I don't know, nothing extensively. We have talked about this extensively in both committees, I think. Paul kind of refresh us on those elements is important. I think we talked about the public policy issue a lot and in passing this from the business committee. But I just think a refresher on what this does, and the Public Utility Commission is here to go over those, and I think their analysis will be helpful.
And we're going to do that, but we're going to first, because his preschool son selected him as the person of the day at his preschool, which is so important, and that starts at 11. We're going to get, if you're available, we'd like to have Kevin Lynch come up and maybe testify in opposition to the bill, and at least we can do one good thing for him and give him his preschool.
Thank you for that, Chair Deckert, and members of the committee. For the record, my name's Kevin Lynch. I represent Pacific Corp Holdings, and I'm not going to try to explain to my son what it is that I do for a living or what I did this morning. Hopefully he'll figure that out a little bit better a little bit later on, but for a four-year-old, it's something that I really can't miss this morning, so thank you very much for indulging me. As you know, our companies have a lot of concerns about this legislation and are opposed to it, and I think a number of the other energy utilities, if not all of them in the state, may well be as well. I want to speak a little bit just briefly about our overall concern on it, and I think it's also important to note that because of the rush of business at the business committee and the succession of amendments that have been incorporated into this bill now, I'm not really sure there's been a real vetting of the substance of the language as it now stands. So I want to make a couple of comments about the specifics of the bill, if that's all right.
Thanks.
Okay. First of all, as I think you know, on an overall basis, we think that this is a fairly discriminatory type of tax and regulatory bill. There are thousands of corporations in Oregon, tens of thousands of corporations in Oregon. My guess is that there are hundreds, if not thousands, that file their federal and state income taxes on a consolidated basis. And Section 3 of this legislation picks on six energy utilities and 22 water utilities to file their state income taxes in a different way. That is of significant concern on its own. In addition, the Dash 6 amendments that were adopted in the Business Committee last week made a further distinction from the Dash 4 amendments by excluding the telecommunications utilities from having to file on a deconsolidated basis as well. I understand from earlier discussion about this issue that the rationale was, well, that those utilities can be distinguished from the energy and water utilities because they are in a competitive environment. And I just would like to point out a couple of things about that. Actually, I think both at least the electric companies and the telecom companies, at least the incumbent telecom companies, are sort of hybrid businesses. Their parts of their business are, in fact, regulated, and parts of them are not. And to make that kind of distinction between the two, there's probably a gray area that should be of some concern. For example, the incumbent local exchange companies in Oregon have state established service territory allocations, just like electric and gas utilities do for the distribution of their service on the local level. On the other hand, there are parts of the business that are competitive. And for the electric utilities, there's competition as well. As you know, we have retail competition and policy in the state. That's one. On another basis, we have competition all the time for our service territory. And over the last 10 years, Pacific Power and Light has lost service territory to municipalizations in Hermiston, Oregon, and around Brownsville and Halsey in Linn County. We faced the threat of losing our service territory in Multnomah County 2 years ago, but defeated that on the ballot. The third thing that's probably worth noting is that our buying and selling of electricity in the wholesale market, what you might think is, I don't know, maybe comparable to the long-distance market for telecommunications, is competitive. It is the prices that are set for buying and selling essentially electricity between utilities, not to end-use customers, or between utilities and marketers at the wholesale level is done under market-based pricing that is under the aegis of the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission and not state regulators, and that is essentially deregulated. So that's a fairly significant thing. In fact, the revenues from our wholesale power sales for just for Pacific Corp are 15 to 20% of our gross utility annual revenues every year, and our expenses for purchases are comparable. We only engage in that business to make sure that we have enough power for our customers when our own plants are not generating enough, and we make sure that when we have a little bit more and our plants are either going to be idle or if they're in surplus, that we sell it to another utility, get the revenue back, and that helps keep our prices stable, or at least helps to keep them down. So it is a competitive business, and the distinctions between telecom and energy utilities is not as clear. Now, I want to assure you I'm not going to suggest to the committee that it amend the bill further to bring the telecoms back into the legislation. I think what I would rather you consider is that you treat us all the same by not requiring the deconsolidation filing on state income tax returns. A couple of other things overall on the bill. As you know, and as I think the Commission's white paper from a couple of months ago pointed out quite eloquently, this legislation through, I believe it's Section 8, requiring the Commission to look at consolidated or to make consolidated tax adjustments in setting retail electric rates for the energy utilities, introduces a whole new element of risk into the way that rates are set. The unregulated affiliates of electric and gas utilities really have little or probably nothing to do with the provision and the price of service to those customers, but reaching up or reaching over and grabbing into the tax advantages or potentially the tax disadvantages of those affiliated businesses puts those customers financially at risk for the activities of businesses that they really have nothing to do with. The Commission has a long-held policy of what's called ring-fencing off utility customers and utility operations financially from the unregulated activities, and that applies to that applies to taxes as well. It has applied to that, and that seems to us to make an awful lot of sense for keeping a clear line of distinction between what the customers of the regulated utilities are responsible for and what the businesses of the unregulated affiliates of the utilities are responsible for. I might add that that as amended, Senate Bill 171 puts the unregulated energy affiliates of the utilities at a competitive disadvantage. For example, our merchant energy affiliate, PPM Energy, which I think some of you are familiar with, but is the second largest developer and marketer of wind energy in America, and has a number of projects either up and running or under construction or planned in the state of Oregon and around the country. It'll put us at a disadvantage for a couple of reasons. One, just by virtue of not being able to file on a consolidated basis, and I can talk about the specifics of Section 3 if you want. But second, because of the disclosure requirements of the income tax forms that I believe are in Section 7 of the bill, there are concerns about about how much of the information that tax information that these merchant businesses would have to disclose to the Oregon Public Utility Commission under the requirement that the consolidated group's tax forms be handed over. That means the release of a fair amount of information about a business that is a very competitive business. And since not all businesses that are competing for that, in other words, other merchant energy companies, are not under the same obligation to disclose that information, it would put companies like PPM at a competitive disadvantage. People would understand better what the finances are, and it would give other companies the ability to operate in more of a financial black box and undercut PPM's ability to compete for projects and to compete for customers. So that's a very dangerous thing from our perspective. Finally, I might add that again, because of the impacts on our renewable energy business, I think that this legislation would undercut the important goal that the state of Oregon has, as articulated by the governor yesterday, to try to increase the amount of renewable energy in all of the utilities portfolios by 1% a year over the next 10 years or so. PPM Energy is the developer and the marketer of wind energy for a project under construction in eastern Oregon called Klondike 2. The bulk of the output of that project, if not all of it, is being sold to PGE to add into its portfolio of renewable energy. If the state wants to meet the aspiration of increasing its renewable portfolio by 1% a year, it's going to need renewable energy developers to provide that resource. And it's very important. PPM Energy is a very financially solid leading developer. It's very important to have high quality, financially sound developers doing these projects for the benefit of the utilities and its customers. And this legislation would diminish the effectiveness and the ability of PPM to do that. A couple of other things just to point out. I think there are a number of technical and wording problems in Section 3 of the legislation. I do want to point out that I know that Senator Metzger and you, Chair Deckard, have made some effort to try to accommodate this concern that I've raised with you previously about our merchant business, but I think the language in Section 3, though well-intended, doesn't really work to create an exception for that. For example, what the meaning of the phrase located in the state is not really clear. The headquarters of PPM are located here. A number of its subsidiary businesses, the way the companies incorporate, are not. So if we have to take those out, we've sort of undercut the intent. Secondly, not really sure what the meaning of primarily conducting energy-related activities is. I think I could be pretty comfortable with that, plain reading of it, but not sure what that might mean 5 or 10 years down the road. And I'm not sure who really interprets that beyond the Department of Revenue. And then the third thing is that I'm concerned about the phrase about the energy activities being located in this state, because while we have a lot of activity going on in our merchant business here in Oregon, we have a lot in a number of other jurisdictions, and I think I've shown you all maps before of where the renewable energy projects are being developed by a group of developers located here in the state. For example, earlier this week, it was announced that PPM is a 50-50 partner with a company called Zilka Energy Systems to develop a 200-megawatt renewable energy project in upstate New York. Now, that's clearly not located in the state, and so if we're doing that, it seems not to work as an exception in that. Might also add that there's probably a constitutional problem with that language, as it would appear to create a restraint on trade and probably violate the Interstate Commerce Clause of the Constitution if we want to keep that kind of limitation. I've mentioned the problem, the concerns we have about turning over the tax forms, and I think that's a bad precedent too, as well. For the revenue department keeps things, I think, to itself in the revenue department. And while there may be an imperative, because the OPUC regulates prices of the electric utilities, to have the information of the utility and its consolidated group, its tax information, provided to the commission, I'm not sure where you stop drawing that line. Should the transportation department get the information, the tax information, of the contractors it does business with for highway and transit projects to make sure that it's not charging too much when it contracts with the state to do a project? You know, that may not be a concern of yours today, but maybe a concern of a future committee a couple of years down the road, and it starts to erode the integrity of the way that tax returns and tax forms are treated. I might add too that there really isn't anything in this legislation that prohibits the commission or restricts the commission from providing in turn that tax information to the general public. And I think that ought to be that, as I mentioned previously, that could clearly put our competitive businesses at a disadvantage, the ones that have to do this, and creates a form of discrimination because some companies would have to divulge that information and some would not. Finally, I guess I would just say in conclusion, back to the original point about what kind of risk this puts the customers at. Many of the states in this country make sure that they keep this line clear between the regulated and the unregulated businesses of the companies in setting rates for customers and making assumptions about how much tax liability there is for those customers. The unregulated businesses that can be around utilities have much less predictable revenue or income and earnings streams than do utilities, generally speaking, though certainly we've had some volatility in the utility business over the last 5 or 6 years as well. And I don't think that in the 2 months since the commission released its white paper to comment on it and then provided some views to this committee and the business committee, I don't think that concern has really been diminished by anybody very substantially. We are bringing in the activities of the unregulated businesses to the customers of the regulated businesses, and that's a very dangerous line to cross in our opinion. And so as a consequence of that, I would recommend to the committee that it not move forward with this legislation. Happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you. Thank you very much for the details, and we'll go to Senator George and then Senator Metzger.
I have an email here, and the person that wrote this makes an interesting statement, and it says it provides no benefit to ratepayers, and then they allege that the purpose of this is to get more money for the state of Oregon. relative to the ratepayers, do you see anything in this bill that would aid the ratepayers? They're not going to get a reduction, from my understanding, or is that a possibility?
Chair Deckert, Senator George, I'm not aware of a way that that would work. If you make an assumption in rates for what the utility may be liable for as a standalone company for income taxes, and you then require them to file on a deconsolidated basis, it shouldn't make any difference to the customers. And if you're a business customer, from a philosophical standpoint, you should be very worried about a number of the precedents that this bill sets.
Senator Metzger.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Lynch, and congratulations on your title. For the just a couple of things. I want to kind of clarify for the record that you made a couple of points, including during your conclusion, about how important it is that we keep the line clear between regulated activities and risks, in this case the ratepayers, and unregulated activities. But in truth, isn't that exactly what we do under the status quo, which is what we're trying to correct with the with a deconsolidated tax return, in that you are allowing, under the government authority that's been given to the PUC and for you as a private entity, to be able to go out to ratepayers and collect taxes, which other companies aren't allowed to do. You are allowed to collect taxes based on the regulated activities of the Public Utility Commission, but you put the customers at risk, because then when on the outflow of that pipe, you get to take your unregulated activities outside the state and negate that. I mean, isn't that exactly your same argument?
Chair Deckert, Senator Metzger, no, I think the answer to that is no, and here's why. There's a fine distinction, I think, to be made on this. Customers do not necessarily equal taxpayers. They're not one and the same. And so the assumption about taxes that are collected in rates as a standalone utility, there's not a hermetically sealed system that those dollars would then go back to benefit the exact same people from whom they are raised. We have three investor-owned electric utilities in this state. We have three investor-owned natural gas utilities in this state. They collect different amount of assumed taxes as utilities in the state, and the money goes in and out in and out of the treasury, and then out at differing rates. I'm not explaining this very well, but there's not. I guess if you're simply assuming that the utility is a tax collector and not a business, then the answer to your question would be yes. But the utility is a business and not a tax collector, why we would be treated under this legislation differently from virtually every other business in the state is really the flip side of the concern and the question that you have.
Can I just ask one question on that? So, because I struggle with that, but this might actually be helpful. When PacifiCorp goes in for a rate case, embedded in those rates, and this is when PacifiCorp goes to the PUC, embedded in there is those customers' taxes, mm-hmm. right into the rates. Mm-hmm. And so the thing that I circle around and try to get a grasp upon is, why would we, and I understand the renewable argument, and for me, the way I, at least in my mind, work around the PPM and the renewable is that that is a separate discussion. The state has many tax credits. We have the energy trust, and we ought to be encouraging and providing incentives for renewables. But why would we, once the taxes have been embedded in customer rates, in the celebrated case, and I know you're not here to talk about the Enron case, but $740 million was mm-hmm. was in customers' rates and then taken out of the state and lost. And I would argue, Senator George, that there was a net loss. Though you're right, it's taxpayers' mm-hmm. loss, manifested in schools and higher ed and community colleges. But I guess that's what I struggle with, is that customers, in my mind, do equal ratepayers or taxpayers mm-hmm. because when a regulated utility that in my mind is different from other businesses in the state because of its defined service territory, that when it goes in, it does embed those rates in. And so why would we then have a tax policy that would, I guess, not take that into account, that actually is occurring?
Chair Deckert, it's a It's a difficult and interesting question. I'm not going to sit here and defend or speak to what another utility and its parent company did. There is a bad model out there. There is a perception that what occurred in that case was not in the public interest. I think I've given you a model of business behavior, which by and large is in the public interest. Let me say this, though. The way that prices for electric and gas service are set are a surrogate for the market. The regulated prices that are set are a surrogate for the market. And it's not a one-sided equation. I think it's really important to remember, with respect to the regulatory compact, that there really are two things to think about. One is that the utility is, in fact, given a monopoly service territory where it has an exclusive franchise to serve those customers. But the other side of the equation is that that utility has the obligation to serve every one of the customers inside that area. And so setting the price for that service by regulation rather than by market forces, at the local level, is simply a surrogate for that. It's a surrogate mechanism. And it's one that makes some sense to do, but it's whether that makes utilities not real businesses is your question, frankly. And I think and there are many respects in which utilities and their parent companies are real businesses. We don't have a lot of differentiation among other businesses when the utility or its parent company needs to go out to the market and raise capital. We compete against every other business in the world for that, with a limited number of people who are willing to buy our shares or buy our bonds. So in that respect, we are very much a real business, and the cost of that is very important to our customers. If we are not an attractive investment, the cost of the capital that we need to raise to build a new power plant or build a new substation goes up, and that cost goes back to our customers. So try to set aside for a minute the equation that is there, or try to remember that there are two sides to that equation for the monopoly service that we are given the opportunity to provide, and remember that there's an obligation on the other side of it.
Mm-hmm. Senator Metzger. Thank you. Well, on that same point, Mr. Lynch, because I want to go back to one of your earlier points also, about you called it a discriminating bill because it treats you different than different corporations, and you just talked about what makes it different. And you are a monopoly. When I go to my wall switch and turn that light on, I only have I'm PGE in that case. I have no choice. I can't go to Costco and Fred Meyer and make those types of choices. And because of that monopoly, and I don't get to set the price. I don't get to shop. If I want a broom, I go to Costco, go to Fred Meyer, whoever has the best price, and those prices are set by what gets me, the customer, in the door to purchase that product. I don't have that choice. Whatever the kilowatt hour is for my electricity, I have to pay. Mm-hmm. And the PUC sets that, and they set taxes as part of that. And that's what distinguishes the businesses that you're involved in, and they provide a great public service. But because they do provide a public service, and because it is a critical necessity of citizens, you have those, like you say, obligations and also given certain rights, and that is to collect taxes on that basis. But I think when you talk about discrimination, you're discriminated against and for. In this case, you're given an opportunity to say, here's your equity, and we're going to give you a return on that. And the guy who's running the hardware store doesn't have the government get to set a return on his investment. If he doesn't sell the inventory, he just loses it.
Chair Deckert, Senator Metzger, a couple of points on that. But let me start with the last thing that you said first. Our company has an opportunity to make a return on equity. Our company in Oregon in 2004 had the opportunity to make 10.7% return on equity. It made 7.4%. In 2001, it had the opportunity to make 10.75%. It made 1.88%. So that guarantee, there is not a guarantee of our return on equity. There is an opportunity. We have to run the business smart. We have to deal with the vagaries of weather, of markets, of the economy, whether it's good or bad, how high loads are. We have all sorts of things that affect the well-being of this business, you know, affect its out, its performance, good or bad financially, that are just like every other business in this state and this country. So I guess I would argue for you that as you said, there are obligations, there are privileges pro and obligations against in the regulatory compact. And I think frankly they battle each other to a draw. And the result of that is that we probably ought to be treated like any other business in this state.
Other questions? Thank you for putting up with our grilling. Enjoy the rest of your day. And if you want Paul or someone from the PUC that go with you to the preschool and describe that deconsolidated tax returns, I don't think
they'll comment on that. But I'm frankly, thank you for the time. I know it's a complicated issue and a difficult one. And your questions, if I can be so bold to say it, are very good ones and very important ones to answer. And it's very easy. This is a very difficult issue. There are a couple of sides to every coin, and we feel it's very important for you to see the side that we think is one worth preserving.
Thank you. Thank you. Commissioner Beyer, would you like to come up? Or we'd like someone from the PUC. I think a request has been made to at least... okay. It's Mr. Graham gets the short stick and gets to come up and tell us what good questions we ask. Good morning.
Good morning, members of the committee. I'm Paul Graham, Oregon Department of Justice, Chief Counsel for the PUC.
You delivered a white paper to us. You delivered a set of recommendations to us. If you could quickly review what your recommendations were, and perhaps a good case was made against those recommendations, perhaps answer at least one or two of the points if you choose to.
This is with respect to 171 now we're talking about?
That's yeah. What we're in work session on.
There were three recommendations, and one of the recommendations was to have the utilities come in every 5 years to file a general rate case if they hadn't been, and it actually was to give the commission the authority to have them come in once every 5 years, and there was some language that is now in the bill that gives the commission the authority to open an investigation, determine whether it is necessary for the utility to come in. The utility can argue that it's not necessary for the utility to come in. And then the commission makes a determination whether it is necessary for the utility to come in or not. And if it determines that it is, then the utility would come in and file a general rate case that would have 90 days or more to prepare the general rate case and submit that to the commission under ORS 757-205, which is a statute that we operate under. And that statute would give the utility the burden of persuasion as well as the burden of going forward with evidence. So it would just be a normal rate case that the commission would be able to force the utility to file. But that's one piece of it. Another piece of it is that the commission can consider what effect, if any, the parent's tax liability has on the cost of the utility for providing service. So if you have an electric utility or a natural gas utility and it has a parent corporation and the parent corporation is paying maybe a lot in taxes or maybe very little in taxes or maybe nothing in taxes, then the commission would be able to consider as a factual issue in a rate case what effect the parent's tax liability, if any, has on the cost of the utility's provision of service. Remember, the commission's job is to determine what it costs PGE or Pacific Core or Idaho Power, or on the gas side, Avista, Cascade Natural, or Northwest Natural, to provide service. And so it would be looking to see, do these tax liabilities, or lack thereof, have any effect on the cost of the utility in the provision of electric service, in the case of the three electrics, or natural gas service, in the case of the three natural gas companies. Parties would be free to raise an issue to say, yeah, there is a connection between the parent's tax liability and the utilities cost, or no, there isn't. So that was another recommendation that the commission had. And then the third piece of this is the third piece of this was simply to give the PUC the ability to obtain this tax information for cases in which parties wish to say that there is some connection between the parent's tax liability and the rates for the utility. The PUC would be able to obtain tax information from the parent of the utility and find out what the parent paid in taxes, because right now the PUC doesn't know what the parent paid in taxes.
Would that information be public, to your knowledge? And Deborah, if you want to help answer that, that would be helpful, because that was one of the questions that was raised.
Yeah. As far as I know, it would be public under the Public Records Act, but I haven't researched the issue. There may be some exceptions in the Public Records Act. There may be some language, and there may be some problems under federal law. One of the things that probably could be done, though, is to have a protective order so that the tax information would not go to the general public. Rather, it would go only to the participants in the rate case. So, for example, if you had a PGE rate case and parties could sign protective orders, that would allow consumer groups like the Citizens Utility Board and the Industrial Customers of Northwest Utilities, Associated Oregon Industries, to receive the information. And any other interveners could receive the information with the understanding that they would use the information only for purposes of the rate case, and they would not disclose it outside the case.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Deborah Buchanan, Department of Revenue. Mr. Chair, we do have authorization in the statute to disclose confidential information in certain cases, and there are provisions that then restrict subsequent disclosure of that information by the recipients. So that is something that could be written into this if you desire to do that.
Thank you. Senator Metz.
I have a question. I'm not sure if it's Paul or if it's Lee. I'd like to have you respond to Mr. Lynch's comment. His overall point was that in terms of keeping the line clear between regulated and unregulated activities, the idea of a deconsolidated tax return versus a consolidated tax return, that this was unfair and provided risk to ratepayers. And I just would like a response from the PUC, since this is one of your recommendations of the deconsolidated tax return, which is what you are collecting the rates on a deconsolidated basis, is to get the counterpoint to his comments.
Okay. Yeah, the other piece of this bill, by the way, was that the utility would fall consolidated.
Yeah, I mean, that's
returns.
The major point here that I think that the utilities are mostly concerned about. They're concerned about it all, but that's they're really concerned about.
And I think the PUC's recommendation was this is a way to remove this as an issue. There are two sides to the issue. One can say that setting rates for standalone utilities is the way to go, and other people may disagree with that. But with respect to state taxes, if you simply have the utility filing a deconsolidated return, then the issue goes away, because then you know that the money that is put into rates for state taxes, it actually may not have been paid because the utility may have done better or worse than we estimated, but there would be a direct payment under state tax law by the utility to the Department of Revenue. So it was simply designed to remove this as an issue. As I say, though, you could have a utility, say, like PGE. I believe it has about $14 million in estimated state taxes built into its rates. And if it has a good year, it may pay more than that. And if it has a bad year, it may pay less than that. And whether it has a good or a bad year can depend on a lot of factors, such as power costs. In 2001, for example, PGE's power costs were substantially in excess of the estimates that we made because of the power crisis, and that means their taxes that they paid, and they were on a standalone basis at that time, were much less than was estimated in rates. And if you just want to look at the taxes, you can say, well, the ratepayers were losers here because there was $14 million in estimated taxes and nothing got paid. But if you look at rates holistically and look at the power costs and everything else, then you would see no, you know, the company had losses, and those losses meant that the company didn't pay the taxes. So this piece about having filed a deconsolidated return wouldn't necessarily mean that if we estimate $14 million, this $14 million is going to be paid. It could be less, and it could be more.
Can I follow up, Mr. Chair? Please. But the point would be, because that's true, that's you have other costs, but those are being collected based on the regulated activity of that utility on behalf of those ratepayers. And they make or lose depending on what those costs are, as opposed to the deconsolidated or the consolidated return, in which they're at risk to unregulated activities that they're also potentially paying for or benefiting from activities by other unrelated companies in other parts of the country.
Well, that's true. If you're going to look at the parent's tax liability, if they're filing a consolidated return, then what the parent would pay would depend not just on what the utility does, but when all sorts of other companies do. And by the way, I should add that a company like PGE doesn't engage just in regulated activities. It has unregulated activities as well. So when you look at what it's paying, it's paying based not only on the regulated activities but the unregulated activities. What we do when we set rates for a utility is we look at just at the regulated operations, and we try to figure out what the taxes a standalone utility would pay on those regulated operations. Bear in mind that there are unregulated operations too. So let's get back to the example of PGE having $14 million built into its rates. That $14 million is built into its rates just for the regulated activities of the company. Let's assume we nailed it right on the head, and PGE had to pay $14 million for the regulated activities. It might make some additional money on its unregulated activities, and it might pay $18 million, say. You don't match up the $18 million and the $14 million. You match up the amount of money it paid for its regulated activities with what's in the rates to see how well we did on our estimate.
Mr. Chair?
Mm-hmm.
Can I ask Mr. Warner a question? Mr. Warner, I understand you've done some look at the taxes that actually were collected on behalf of the utilities from the state. And I would be curious any information in terms of giving us a perspective on what actually has been collected.
Yeah. Senator Metzger, I asked the Department of Revenue to give a general look at the revenue from the industry, and so that to not get into any individual companies, of course, which they cannot do under our disclosure laws, but just to give you a sense of the amount of revenue that's generated by the industry, this would be the utilities in question. They all do file as consolidated companies, so we know that that there is a consolidated group. There's a wide range in terms of what proportion comes back to Oregon, so it varies a lot as to what the percentages are. But in terms of the revenue from that industry group, over the 2000 to 2002 tax years, it varied from $1.5 million to $5 million. For the industry as a whole.
That was collected by the state.
That was collected by the state, right, from those returns.
Total.
Right, from that industry as a total filing as consolidated returns.
And that's four tax years?
That would be three tax years.
Or three tax years.
Right. It varied from $1.5 million to $5 million.
And then, Mr. Graham, so we talked about PG has built in roughly $14 million in state tax
into
the rate.
Right, yeah.
Can you give me just a ballpark of what Pacific Core and Northwest Natural have built into their rates? Because these are the ones that we know $1.5 million to $5 million total was collected over a 3-year period. What, on an annual basis, would a Pacific Core has built into their rates or Northwest Natural, for example?
I don't know, but I can get those figures, I think.
Would they be commensurate at all? Are we talking ballpark figures similar here? Or?
Well, Northwest Natural, I'm sure, would be below that. That's
yeah.
A much smaller company. And Pacific Core, if you look at the entire operation, is bigger, but within the state, it's smaller. So my guess is that would be smaller as well, too. But I think we could get those figures. By the way, the way we estimate the taxes is that when you set rates, you really have two buckets of money. You're coming up with what's called a revenue requirement. And one of the buckets is the return on investment. The utilities make investment to serve ratepayers, and you have an authorized return. That's the return on debt, on preferred, and on equity. And that's where the profit of the utility comes from. The other bucket is recovery of estimated expenses, and the key word is estimated. And the expenses include things like power costs and wages and depreciation and operations and maintenance on the plant. And, of course, one of them is taxes. And the way the taxes are figured is that at the end of the rate case, we look to see what the net revenue of the utility will be, and then apply the federal and state tax rates to the net revenue, and then that's added on to revenue requirement. I'm oversimplifying because there are a few other bells and whistles involved, but that's basically what's done when you estimate taxes for a standalone utility. That's the approach that's used. So you're determining the estimated net revenues that the revenue requirement will generate, and then applying the federal and state tax rates to those estimated net revenues. So you're looking just at the regulated operations of the utility, not the total operations, just regulated operations of the utility.
Mr. Chair, I'll conclude. I just would like to make one comment, though. We'd be interested to have those figures of what was built into the rates, because clearly just with the information we have, I think it's important to talk about the theory and then the reality. And what this bill attempts to do is get to the reality, not just the theory. And in this three-year period, just with the PGE alone, if you build in, they've collected $42 million in over a three-year period at 14 a year. Is that right? Yes, that's $42 million. And then the total energy collection was 1.5 to 4, 5 for all of them. So even if you collected nothing from, you know, Pacific Core or Northwest Natural, let's just say that for example, this is a huge discrepancy. And when we find out what that rate structure is, clearly the theory works, which great in testimony, but in on the ground, the fact of the matter is this does not actually, we don't have those big bumps and spikes in which, golly gee whiz, the ratepayer had to pay more because they really got an advantage. That I had asked the committee, in business committee, Mr. Chair, if any of them in the last 10 years could find a time in which they actually paid more than they actually collected. And I did hear back from Representative Pacific Core that they did find a year. They found one year in which they actually paid more in taxes than they collected. And that was the only year out of 30 tax years that I have heard from. So I just want to kind of put that on the record. And I would be interested, so we can get an idea of what the collections have been for the energy companies. We know now they've only 1.5 to 5 million, according to Department of Revenue, has been collected. That's a huge discrepancy. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Senator George.
Do we have an answer to this question? And is that of the states that collect income tax, how many of them prohibit filing consolidated income tax returns?
Do you know that, Mr. Chairman?
I don't know.
Do any of them prohibit filing consolidated?
I don't know. That would be a question for someone with a background in the taxation. I'm a regulatory lawyer. I have no idea what the answer is.
Mm-hmm.
My thought being is that, if we are going to be the only one doing this, to see a flight of capital for investment, I mean, we're asking that to happen in a state where it's bad. We put forward legislation that encourages this. I don't know. I'd like to have an answer to that question.
Mm-hmm. And I have a guess at it, but I don't want to render it, because I think there are very few that require a deconsolidated, which this bill proposes.
But we wouldn't be the first and the only.
Okay. Well, other states do. We heard a lot about Pennsylvania, who does a true-up. We can get that. I mean, there are other states. I want to say 41 states have the consolidated form on their regulated utilities. Mr. Grimm, why, when we do the rate setting, are we missing the mark so greatly where, as Senator Metzger was just saying, it's we factor in the taxes for our businesses and our residential customers, and there seems to be just such an incredible discrepancy between what we think the tax liability and what actually becomes the tax liability.
Well, there's an argument about whether the PUC is missing the mark. I mean, the idea in rate setting is to estimate the cost for the utility, not for the parent. It's for the utility. And when you say that taxes didn't get paid, I think we do have data that would show that, let's take PGE again, it actually made tax payments to Enron. So it incurred a cost. And I think if you look at some of the numbers, you'll find that the PUC's estimates were not all that inaccurate.
So when it made its tax payments to Enron, because my understanding is that when you factor those taxes in, say what you look at the Oregon laws. So you factor in the Oregon tax laws, and you say PG customers are going to pay X based on Oregon laws. When those monies were taken and distributed to Enron, where did the Oregon tax liability end up?
Because of Oregon tax law, the parent corporation, Enron, is allowed to file a consolidated return, offset gains with losses, and pay no tax. That's a tax problem. It's not a regulatory problem. Again, our job at the PUC is to estimate what it costs an electric utility to provide a kWh of electricity, and it's to estimate what a natural gas company is going to incur in providing a therm of gas. And you use the standalone approach to do that. That's what virtually all states do. That's what the federal government does, because that's the actual cost to the utility. And that's what you're reflecting, is the cost to the utility. An example might be, I know you see a distinction between regulated and unregulated prices, but I buy an Oregonian for 35 cents. I'm sure some of that is estimated federal and state taxes. Let's say it's a nickel. And the Oregonian is owned by Knight Ridder, and let's say Knight Ridder has a bad year, estimates, and it pays no taxes. Does that mean that I should have paid 30 cents for the Oregonian rather than 35 cents? It's the same issue here on the regulated side.
But are they the same animal? And that's the fundamental question, because if you agree, if you guys want to revisit your recommendations, I think you should. but the question we have before us is, are they the same animal? When you purchase that Oregonian, do you have other options available to yourself? And I would pose the same question is, when you go home tonight and you flip that light switch, do you have options available to yourself?
Well, I think the response would be that, first of all, we're just trying to propose a solution here. And the solution, we think, is you could simply have them file a state deconsolidated state tax returns, and then people wouldn't worry about the issue that I've raised with respect to the Oregonian, or the issue that has been on the table with respect to PGE and Enron. You would make sure that the money that is in rates is something that will be paid to the taxing authority, although, as I said earlier, it may not be the same amount. It may be more and it may be less. But is there a difference? Well, it depends. If you want to draw a distinction between regulated and unregulated price setting, you can do that. On the other hand, you can say that the way to judge the fairness of a commodity is to look at the costs that are necessary to produce the commodity, whether it's a regulated commodity or an unregulated commodity.
Mm-hmm. Well,
that's the argument on the flip side, that there really shouldn't be any distinction between regulated and unregulated. But again, I'm not here to get into that debate. I'm simply here to say that the PUC's proposed solution, at least with respect to state taxes, and we can't propose anything with respect to federal taxes because we don't have authority, is that the utility can file a deconsolidated state tax return. And again, that may not get you exactly what's in rates. Every single estimate we make in rate setting, everyone guaranteed is going to be wrong. It's going to be too high. It's going to be too low. Taxes are no different. Always going to be off. Mm-hmm. And that's why all the federal cases that look at rate making say don't look at cases on an issue-by-issue basis. Rate making is holistic. In fact, I supervise a group of attorneys, and I tell them there are three rules they need to learn about rate making. Rule number one is rate making is holistic. Number two is holistic. And number three is the same as the first two. It's holistic. One cannot judge the fairness of rates by selecting one item and saying, aha, somebody got ripped off. The issue is whether the rates as a whole are just and reasonable. A number of Supreme Court cases set that precedent. The most recent one is one called Duquesne Power and Light. The precedent originally came from the Pope Natural Gas case in 1944. But that's a key issue in rate making. And what one needs to understand is that one cannot judge the fairness of rates by looking at one issue. There are a number of elements that go into rate making. We're always going to be wrong in every one of our estimates, but overall, are the rates fair? That's the real question.
We're needed on the floor. I'm willing to stay. Senator George, do you have another one to ask question? Or?
No, it's okay, but this holistic thing, as far as I'm concerned, includes also looking at the whole utility, no matter where they're located. In other words, if you have a holding in Oregon and you have a holding somewhere else, I think you're almost going to have to measure that, the well-being of the overall company, in setting a rate. And so if you take it out here, isn't that utility going to come back and say, I need to make it up in some other area with some additional consideration for my cost?
Well, when we look at utility, we're just looking at the regulated operations. We're not looking at anything that's unregulated. So utility may have a subsidiary that's outside the state that's doing something unregulated. We ignore that for rate-setting purposes. Okay. But, again, what we are attempting to do is to take a snapshot of the utility's estimated expenses and a snapshot of the appropriate return on equity and setting our rates based on that. We know our snapshot is going to be wrong. We hope it overall provides for a fair rate.
Thank you. I'd like to, if we could, get Dan Meek and Liz Trojan, just so we finish the folks who came down here today. Please just come up quickly, and we don't have much time because we're voting on the Senate floor right now. Thank you, Ms. Graham. You're included.
Thank you.
And we are, as you can see,
we'll hurry.
They're calling the roll on us. Please. Good morning.
Good morning. My name is Dan Meek. I live in Portland, Oregon. I'm an attorney. I've represented ratepayers before Oregon and other state PUCs for about 23 years. I've distributed written testimony and an editorial from the Oregonian entitled True Up Utility Taxes from February 26th of this year. And unfortunately, SB 171A does not true up utility taxes. It's being portrayed as the solution to the fact that utilities are charging us hundreds of millions of dollars. In fact, the amount is about $150 million a year now. We're paying these utilities for their alleged cost of state and federal income taxes that, in fact, they're not paying. This bill does not solve the problem. It would not accomplish the true-up that the Oregonian and others call for. As my testimony states, in fact, it would accomplish virtually nothing except to authorize the Oregon PUC to continue its abusive practice of allowing utilities to charge ratepayers for income taxes that neither the utility nor its corporate parent ever pays. First, it requires the public utility not to file a consolidated state return. Well, PGE is fully and the other utilities as well, have fully complied with this for the entire period that they have been consolidated with their corporate parents, such as Enron. PGE filed no consolidated state return. So this provision is meaningless. This provision does not require the public utility to file any state tax return at all, and PGE filed none for 1998, 99, 2000, 2003, and 2004, perhaps 2001 as well. So this provision doesn't accomplish anything. Second, it would allow a public utility to file a modified consolidated state return on behalf of an affiliated group that is limited to includable corporations that are located in the state and that primarily conduct energy-related activities in the state. Well, as Mr. Lynch pointed out, there isn't any definition of located in this state. Further, the charging of phony state income taxes to ratepayers is in no way prevented by this provision. PGE actually filed non-consolidated state income tax returns in 2002. It charged ratepayers, the actual number is not $14 million, it's $15.6 million in rates for state income taxes, charged us $15.6 million for state income taxes and paid $10. Mr. Graham said, well, PGE I don't even have time to respond to the various incorrect statements that have been made so far today. PGE alone has charged ratepayers on a per ratepayer basis since 1997, $1,000 per ratepayer in state and federal income taxes that PGE and Enron have not paid. The other utilities are performing the same practice. I can tell you the approximate amounts if you like. Third, the bill applies its provisions only to tax years starting on or after January 1st, 2006. Thus allowing the utilities to retain all of the money they've already charged to ratepayers for phony taxes in the past. Fourth, it requires the utility to show every 5 years why it should not have a general rate case. This doesn't solve the problem or even address it. Utilities have general rate cases at various intervals now. The PUC can require a utility to file a general rate case anytime it wants to under existing law. It doesn't solve the problem. Fifth, it allows the PUC to authorize the incorporation into rates of estimated federal and state taxes. Well, that's the problem. That's exactly what the PUC is doing now. This authorizes the PUC to continue the problem and doesn't tell the PUC to stop. It then states, in determining estimated federal and state taxes, the Commission shall take into account the effects of filing federal returns on a consolidated basis. This doesn't mean anything, because it doesn't state how the PUC is supposed to take that into account. The PUC's current practices would easily pass muster if this statute were enacted. It wouldn't change anything. Also, the proposal does not even look at which federal returns the PUC is supposed to look at. PGE filed no federal returns in the years mentioned above, so there's no federal return to look at. Finally, the bill is based on the assumption that the problem occurs only because of consolidation of returns with corporate parents, but that's not the case. PGE was not consolidated with Enron in 2002, charged the $15.6 million, paid $10. Consolidation is not the only problem. It is a part of the problem, but it's not the entire one. Instead of this bill, the committee should return to Senate Bill 408, which would solve the problem entirely. It is a true-up. It is what the Oregonian has called for, truing up tax payments, truing up what you charge ratepayers for income taxes, what the utility really paid for income taxes, and it would be a fine solution if you simply changed one word from is to has been. Senate Bill 408 would solve this problem, but Senate Bill SB 171A would not. I appreciate the opposition of the Pacific Witness. It had a little bit of the flavor of Brer Rabbit and the Briar Patch, however, because this bill wouldn't accomplish the solution that you're seeking.
Thank you. Dan Meek joining the utilities in opposition to this bill.
Ms. Trojan, and we literally are missing votes.
I'll be really fast. My name is Liz Trojan. I'm not an attorney or a tax expert. I have a brief comment on Senate Bill 171. I'm with the Oregon Public Power Coalition. We're a community group dedicated to creating public ownership of our local utility, Portland General Electric. We're concerned about, we believe that any regulated utility that collects taxes in their rates should be paying those taxes, not pocketing them. We're concerned about tax monies collected through our local utility, monies that have not made it into the state or local coffers, money to the tune of $92.6 million, currently totaling $740 million. In our opinion, Senate Bill 171A does not adequately address this issue. Senate Bill 408 does directly address this issue in the form of the true-up. We cannot, should not allow $730 million in taxpayer money to evaporate into thin air. We need this money for schools, police, and other government services. We encourage you to drop Senate Bill 171 and move forward with Senate Bill 408. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Commissioner Beyer, I have a question for you. The thought occurs to me because you have this taxpayer versus ratepayer issue. If you could please come up. Why don't we just, I know how we can definitely benefit ratepayers, is just ameliorate the tax burden altogether and just say that ratepayers of regulated utilities will pay no state taxes. Therefore, the utility doesn't charge them, doesn't factor it into the PUC holdings, and everyone wins there. The utility wins, the ratepayer wins, and the whole tax issue is gone.
And your question is?
Well, you guys spent a couple years on this. To me, that was the first time that occurred to me, but that might be a possible solution where I don't know where your opposition comes from, that you just would, the state would say.
All the other corporations have to pay taxes. That's where all the opposition.
Mr. Chair, for the record, I'm Lee Beyer, Chairman of the Oregon Public Utility Commission. Having spent many years on your side of the table, I think the issue is the one that Senator Metzger just raised. It's always the issue of, you know, who's paying what. You know, I recall that I believe a study or a review that that Paul's office did a couple of years ago in 2001. We went out and looked, and I think there were 17,000, I believe, corporations that paid $10, and I suspect that none of them reduced their prices. So it's a legitimate issue. And the problem in taxation, as you well know, is that you set a tax rate on one side, and then you set a lot of other public policies that for various goods, public goods, you allow offsets or credits against those. So that's where you get there. The reality is that none of these companies that we're talking about have violated the law.
I agree with that.
They're all filing their taxes legally and paying less. They're paying the amount of tax that the legislature and Congress has determined is appropriate. The problem in the rate setting side for us, and this sort of gets to your question, is we don't know how all those things are going to apply up front. I suppose one way to get at that, what as Mr. Meek suggested, to true up, but our legal counsel in the Attorney General's office says we can't do that. It's problematic. Now, there are differences of legal opinion on what you can do and can't do, but I, as an administrative or state agency, are bound by what the Attorney General advises us, so we have a legal dilemma there, and I guess you're as the you get the short straw. You're the legislature, and you get to decide what the policy is and what the laws of the state are. So I'm going to turn it back to you. One answer would be, going fully around to your question, is if you didn't require taxes to be paid at all by utilities, that would certainly solve the problem, and frankly, in the rate-setting process, we would reduce the return on equity commensurate with that.
So it would flow through to the ratepayer.
Right.
Thank you, Marge. Thank you very much. Last to Ms. Cofori and Mr. DiMaso.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Marge Cofori, representing the City of Portland, and I will be very brief. The clerk is bringing you a letter that the City Council wrote to the Public Utility Commission on March 4th of this year, urging that the Utility Commission change its practices of allowing taxes to be collected in rates and then not having them paid. The policy objectives that the city is interested in having accomplished here is that if a utility does collect the tax dollars in its rates, that those tax dollars must be remitted to the taxing jurisdiction. And you've talked about this, of course, a lot. I think the expectation of a customer who pays a bill but has tax on that bill is that the expectation from that customer is that those taxes are actually paid to the taxing jurisdiction. So I think that's what the City Council is trying to address. You've heard different opinions as to whether the language before you in Senate Bill 171A actually accomplishes that or not, and I'm certainly not able to tell you whether we think it does, but that is the policy objective that they hope that you will achieve through legislation this session. Thank you.
And Mr. Mazin, we now are informed we are starting to vote, and so
It's just some brief comments, Chair. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Ernie Del Mazo. I'm president of Dell Information Services and a paralegal. I had a few comments on some of the statements made. Commissioner Beyer, for one, brought forth this statement that other businesses basically also did not pay taxes or paid the minimum. I might add that those other businesses were not monopolies, and they did not specifically charge their customers for taxes that were never paid. Other comments are that the PLC currently has authority to get tax records directly from the utilities. We don't understand their statement. Yes, Enron did receive our money, but the end fact is ratepayers paid these taxes, and we did not receive them. One noteworthy fact that many aren't aware of is during the years that Enron owned PGE 97, at least till its bankruptcy in 2001, Enron actually received net tax rebates of $387 million. It kept our money and actually got rebates from the federal government. Of course, that was for federal taxes. Obviously, since bankruptcy, it hasn't paid taxes and continues to collect almost $2 million a week from us. The PSC has continually allowed PGE to charge income taxes, and it's actually cited against consumer advocate groups who've gone to court in defense of ratepayers. This bill does absolutely nothing except perhaps give PGE legal cover to keep the $730 million that's already charged ratepayers. And I might add that that $730 million divided by 175,000 ratepayers, again, $1,000 per ratepayer on average, is a substantial amount of money. And I do thank you for your time.
Thank you. Thank you.
Yeah, and just one comment before we conclude, and thank you for your testimony. As you know, Senate Bill 408 was the one that I sponsored with Senator Walker originally, and to get this, and we heard from more extensively previously from the both PUC and former Commissioner Ron Ekus, who were detailing the issues of why they said the true-up wouldn't work. Part of the, I think the difficulty we have had with this legislation over the last 2 years is, you know, not only the warring attorneys, but the warring philosophies, which I guess at the very end does come to one conclusion, and that is you reach no conclusion, so nothing gets done, and that's one of the problems we face. I think we're facing that again, that nothing will change because of that. I think it would be very, very interesting for the members of the Public Utility Commission to, from the legal standpoint, is to, and Mr. Meek, I would suggest also would be a great contributor to this, if in fact the arguments regarding the original 408, which Mr. Chair is also in this committee, on the true-up, we're talking about, you know, legal authorities, if that could be clarified once and for all, I mean, that'll help give us guidance on 171. Because that was the original intention, and I realized the utilities didn't like that one either. But I was particularly impressed with the testimony of Mr. Ekus, who I think has a good broad view of these things, who had issues with that. So I think that would be a good research if Mr. Warner could, again, revisit those issues and find out why is it, again, that we are limited in the true-up position, and maybe clearly articulate that to the committee. I think that would just kind of help us sort this issue out. Because I think it's too important of an issue to just let sit again for another session with no activity.
Mr. Chairman,
Senator,
I know we need to hurry. 42 states do allow consolidated. If, in fact, we were to withdraw from that, my question is this. Does anyone have an opinion as to whether or not that might impact investment in Oregon?
Mm-hmm. It's a good question, but I don't know who the right person, but, I mean, I would look to Gary Bauer at Northwest Natural or someone at PacifiCorp or someone or Teresa at PGE, and it's going to be the parent company, and so you're going to have mm-hmm. to look at where the parent company has other operations.
Right.
PacifiCorp is the easiest to look at because they have significant operations outside the borders of Oregon.
Right.
I'm not as sure in terms of PGE and Northwest Natural, but I hope Teresa or Gary might be able to meet with us and talk with us about that because we're going to reschedule this next week.
We have it scheduled for Monday, Mr. Chair. Yeah.
And that's going to be too early,
I think. Yeah,
so we'll revisit whether Monday is the day to come back to us. Thank you very much. Closed work session. Senate Revenue till 9 a.m. Monday.
Yes.
How did we get to
Well, it's because we didn't get 171 until late, mm-hmm. so we posted it. So we posted it like at 9.
But we have the other bills.
I know, and so what they did was post them all at 9:30 instead of. I know, and then we ended up getting squeezed. Yeah.
So we have to, yeah. I mean, if that happens again, let's try to get it. If we have to, I'd play well in this. Let's do the last bills so that we can actually start.
Well, if we could go ahead and set something for next week. The food processing is coming Wednesday. So, and then you've got 841 on Tuesday. And are you okay with me just throwing in a few house bills?
Sure.
Okay. And we'll have a schedule set for the week.
Yeah, I know. I realize that 80% of the game is me telling you guys what bills actually
mm-hmm. what you're ready to hear.
What we're ready to hear, and if I'm not making stuff that available, then mm-hmm. you know, or call you for 15 minutes and try to hunt you down the building, that limits your ability to actually.
Okay, we'll try to get this set up for next week. And
sure.
Do you want to meet again?
Sure. Oh, yeah. You're guaranteed to meet.
Yeah. What I'll do is I'll go ahead and with what we didn't get to today, I'll go ahead and set up a schedule next week, and then I'll chat with you.